Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Well, speak up, kōrerotia tēnei, ko tāle kaltana hou. Well, it's the start of a new year, and we're thinking about the funding landscape of Aotearoa New Zealand. This idea has come about because an organisation called Fund Sorter, which is a very new organisation, has just released a report giving some insights into the contemporary funding priorities around the motu. And we've got Lani Evans here, who's one of the Fund Sorter co-founders, so it will be great to hear from her. But it did get me thinking about what are some of these funding priorities? Are we seeing any trends across time? And what does that mean for us as a country and our philanthropic sector, which is a big one, I believe, internationally speaking as well? We've got three guests today, Lani Evans, as I mentioned, but also Tase Vaoga and Duncan Matthews, who are going to be talking us through different elements of funding. It would be really lovely to hear from each of you a wee bit about yourselves, ko wai koe, he aha tō mahi, those sorts of things. What do you do? What got you into the role? What are your kind of drivers, your passions? Tase, how about we start with you?
Tēnā koe, aotira, tēnā tātou. Ko wai au, he iri tēnei, no hāmua, no tētai tokirau, no āpui ahau, ara, ko no te awa tupua, ara, ko Wakanui tēnei, ko Tase tōku ingoa. Kia ora, I'm Tase, and I come from the community sector. Started out as a budding youth worker and then moved into kind of a fundraising role in the early 2010s, and have since kind of worked in that end management, project management, funding, and then also in the philanthropy sector. Kia ora tāku. Kia ora tātou.
Yeah, nā koe. And how about Duncan?
Yeah, kia ora koutou. Called Duncan Matthews Aho. I grew up down in the Waikato. I'm currently living in the wonderful Tamaki Makaurau, which I do enjoy and call home now. My ancestors are from England and Scotland primarily. And yeah, I got into this mahi through university, actually, down the Waikato again. Quickly elected, I think my first meeting of the UniQ group down there, I was elected as secretary because that's how things roll in small community. And that sort of stayed with me. When I moved to Tāmaki, I quickly got involved with a few organizations up here. And that led to relatively quickly leaving my cushy software development gig. I often say I'm a recovering software developer, and working in the community space, similar to Tase, as a, you know, manager, sort of in those roles. Over time, I've also started working in the philanthropic space at Foundation North, which some people might know, but also for the Rural Foundation. The Rural Foundation is a rainbow-specific or LGBT and takatapui-specific funder, named for someone called Peter Rule, very imaginative, who experienced a lot of that sort of social discrimination through the 60s, 70s, and 80s in this country in Aotearoa. Yeah, I was brought onto that trust and have been a trustee or advisor for about 10 years now there, but I'm sure we're going to talk more about our mahi later on. Kia ora.
Kia ora. And Lani, thank you so much for pulling all this together. It would be great to hear from you as well.
Thank you so much for having us for this kōrero. Kia ora koutou, ko Lani Evans aho. I grew up in Brisbane, actually, in Australia. And I moved to Aotearoa, to Dunedin, actually, in my early 20s, originally to make a rock climbing documentary. And I've never really left. I fell in love with the geography of Aotearoa, but more so with the communities. And I now live in Porirua, and I'm the mama to two small humans, which is an absolute delight. I started working in community sector through making adventure documentaries and using them as a way to talk to young people about help-seeking behaviour and supporting each other. And that quickly moved into running community organisations and eventually into philanthropy because I got so frustrated with the way that funding and philanthropy operated in Aotearoa, the lack of transparency, the lack of accountability from funders. And so moved to kind of, I guess, that part of the community sector and spent about a decade working in philanthropy, running foundations, and am now one of the co-founders and CEO of Fundsorter, which is aiming to solve some of those challenges with funding from a different perspective.
Could you talk us through Fundsorter a wee bit? What was the kind of rationale and what exactly does it do?
Fundsorter really started as an idea when I was on parental leave with my daughter, who's just turned 3. And really it was about, one, we know that there are really big challenges for community organisations when it comes to funding. The sector is really complex. There's a lot of opaqueness. It's really hard to find the right funding opportunities, and it's really time consuming to then make applications to funders. And so people have known about this problem for a long time, have tried to solve it in a number of ways. But when generative AI became something that we could access, it felt like an opportunity to try and solve that problem in a new way. And so what we've done at Fundsorter, we're a social enterprise and we're set up to make it faster and easier for community organisations to access contestable funding. So we have a database of about 2,500 funding opportunities. We have a smart matching algorithm and we have an AI-driven drafting tool so that community organisations can sign up. They can tell us a bit about what they do, their co-popper, a bit about what their funding needs are, and then we find the right funding opportunities for them, draft that application, and in the near future, we'll be able to draft their accountability reports as well. So it's really about making it faster for people to find the right matches and then faster for them to go through that application process. And our goal is to reduce the funding burden for community organisations by about 90%.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah.
The funding burden, what exactly do you mean by that?
So when I think about the funding burden, and Tasse and Duncan, feel free to jump in because you'll have your own perspectives, it's how much kind of time and resource and burden is placed on community organisations by funders through that process of seeking funding and being accountable for that funding. And, you know, it can be a really big chunk of community sector's time. Kate Frickberg, who does a lot of work in the philanthropic space, wrote an article a few years ago talking about the funding burden, and she'd done some calculations on how much time in the overall capacity of community sector is spent on that funding process. And it was really significant. And for some funders, the funding burden that they create for community can even be more expensive than the amount of money that they're giving. So it's how do we get that balance right so that funders get what they need and are able to make good decisions without placing too much of a burden and a barrier on community organisations whose time is better spent actually doing coalface work on the ground to make outcomes better for communities and people and environment.
I used Fundsorter for one of the groups I was supporting over the last 6 months. And one thing I really noticed about it is the way it guides you into making your first application. So I think the opaqueness of how to actually apply to funders is a huge issue. You know, you search and you might find them, but then it's like, well, how actually do I get started? And if you talk to 10 different funders, they'll have 10 different processes, and there's no way to, they don't give you an overview of how to do it for them, let alone for everyone else in most cases. So one thing I quite liked about Fundsorter was just I don't want to use the term generic, that sounds bad, but the step-by-step process that it goes through to talk about your organization, talk about your needs, and then match that up to who could potentially fund you. And it's just starting on the journey. It's so valuable, let alone all the other time-saving pieces.
Yeah, 100%. I started out my career as a grant writer when I was a fundraiser, and the calculations that Kate Frickberg did were about that it would cost about 45% of the grant actually funnels into actually preparing the grant, doing accountabilities, etc. And when that came out, kind of I reflected on that first role as a grant fundraiser, and a lot of that was actually applying for what we kind of called scholarships for gifted learners. And it was just to cover the cost of their participation in the programs that we ran. And they're small amounts. And actually what we were asking for was 50% of the cost of doing that from funders. But actually 50% of the money that they gave was actually, you know, caught up in the administration of that grant. And so less was actually going to the learner and having that impact in the community. And as Duncan reflected, in contrast, the ability to go into fund sorter and move through a process to make an application just was like saved so much time. I recently use it for our Mid-Eye, and we do usually once or twice a year, we do a bunch of applications to funders that we normally apply to anyway. So we already know about them, but this just made it so much simpler because we could then more easily match the ask that we're making to a particular funder and then go to those funders directly. I think I honestly feel like I have saved hundreds of hours by going through that process.
It's really lovely for me to hear. I mean, one of the other things, like when I think about why I moved into the philanthropic space from running community organisations, I think there's also an equity piece that we have to be really aware of. And for me, that was, I have a very clear memory of, you know, getting a bunch of funding for the youth organisation that I was running at the time. And then seeing an organisation that also worked in the same space, completely unable to get resource at all. And in my mind, they were actually doing a better job than we were of the work with the young people. The difference was that I have a communications degree. I've had a whole bunch of privileges that allowed me to speak in the language of the funders really easily. I could kind of imagine myself as them. I could imagine what it was they were looking for. I could interpret their applications really well. And the people in the other organization could not do that. And so that injustice for me was like really the spark for stepping into that philanthropic space. And I don't think we've solved that yet, but I do think that we can use tools like FundSorter and others to try and level that playing field a bit more, particularly for people who might experience disabilities or people for whom English isn't their first language or who are new to the New Zealand environment and the funding space as well.
I think one thing I've noticed working on what's called the Applicant Experience Project at Foundation North, we've been putting dedicated time and effort into making things easier, is the collective trauma in the nonprofit sector. I'm just going to use that word. because 2 years ago, we did a project to make impact funding easier. So that's the report that most funders require you to provide at the end of the grant once you've spent the money. And we asked ourselves some pretty hard questions, like, actually, all you need to do is tick a box saying you spent the money. So we reduced our whole form for smaller grants down to two tick boxes, and then you could just submit it. But what we find is that actually 80 to 90% of people still write a lot or feel like they have to attach their receipts for everything they've spent, because that's so ingrained in the risk aversion behavior of our nonprofits, of our charities, because some of our bigger funders, such as the gaming trusts, if you mess up once, if you miss one comma in your application, you're just declined, because they're all about compliance and you just have to tick all their boxes and then you have a shot at getting money. If you don't, you're out. And so people will go above and beyond. They'll try and make sure they've ticked everything, provided everything, so there's no reason not to be funded, versus trusting that the funders, when they say you only need to tick these two boxes and click submit, that's actually all you need to do. But they kind of don't believe it because of all their other experiences. Yeah.
Duncan, you mentioned some of the big funders being a gaming trust. It would be great to have a kind of a general sense of what the funding landscape is like. I know there are some big funders, and then there are lots and lots of sort of smaller groups as well. And how does that kind of play into all of this?
Yeah, I've been talking about this with a couple of people recently, actually, and it's quite handy to start at the top in terms of not just thinking about the types of funders, but also the kind of big foci, I think is the plural, of funding. And, you know, there's sports, there's arts, there's a growing sector around environment in particular. And then there's kind of a lot get jumbled into community. I'm sure there's many other ways that things get sliced and many other big focuses. But the money that comes from lotteries, for example, so if you are buying your Wednesday and Saturday ticket or doing an instant Kiwi, that gets split out into community arts or sports funding. So that's one of the big ones. The Pokie machines, there's about 20 different kind of trusts, 20 to 40, depending how you count, and they make up a huge portion of local sports funding across Aotearoa. They almost 70% of their pūtea goes towards sports. And then we have the community trusts like Foundation North. There's 12 of those across the country, and they were established out of the sale of the original regional banks. Like if you think Auckland Savings Bank, ASB, TSB still exists, and a few other banks. Help me out. Lani, and see, what are the other ones?
There are a lot of family foundations and there are corporate foundations as well. Those are the primary ones when you think about institutional philanthropy. And for me, I always like to talk about, we have institutional philanthropy, which is the trusts and the foundations and lotteries, et cetera. And then we also have individual philanthropy. And almost all of us are individual philanthropists to some level. It's just whether it's, you know, $1 million you're giving away a year from your kind of personal funds, or like $5. We're almost all philanthropists, and I think it's really important to understand that those two things can exist next to each other. But yeah, in terms of institutional philanthropy, I'd say that adding to yours is the family foundations, who we actually have quite a lot in New Zealand. They are extremely broad in terms of both their size. You've got things like the Tyndall Foundation, which are really large and very strategic, through to smaller ones, and a lot that actually are not very public about the work that they do. And then the corporate foundations, so things like Te Rauro, the One Aotearoa Foundation, but again, also lots of corporate philanthropic programs that are not set up as foundations or trusts.
Yeah, I've got the figures here, right? It's a 2020 report now, so it's a bit old, but the sort of total philanthropic giving is about $4 billion. And about half of that, they kind of say, is private donations. So that gives you maybe a sense of the scale. I think what's interesting is the effect of government into the space as well. And that's in two ways, actually. So the lotteries pūtea, that is technically all run by the Department of Internal Affairs, which is government, right? So even though we think of it as philanthropic money, so think of it as government money. And then government has increasingly sort of contracted the nonprofit space to deliver services on their behalf, maybe rather than funding and delivering services directly, as per, you know, say, the health sector. So I think that's had a huge impact on how the nonprofit sector sort of positions itself, because now you're suddenly saying, oh, well, we can either go and get sort of, you know, a few thousand dollars from COGS, Community Organization Grant Scheme, that's the really small pūtea, which is sort of 36 different local committees across the country. So it really is local small funding, all the way up to nonprofits, which kind of basically act like a corporate or act like an organization, because they have their millions of dollars a year government contract and they're delivering to that. So how is that really different, you know, most other entities we think of that size? And I can start talking a bit more about competition, but I feel like maybe pushing too fast.
Well, I think competition is a really, really critical element in the whole funding space, actually. So jump in.
Well, I did some of my master's on collaboration within the nonprofit community, and I specifically wanted to look at small nonprofit organizations. That's my passion, and there are lots and lots of smaller nonprofit organizations. You know, that tier three, tier four space make up 95% of our nonprofits and charities. And going back to kind of what I said before earlier about the trauma of what you have to do to apply, that extends to how people apply for funding. So, you know, oh, I found this funding opportunity, but I don't actually want to share it with my mates over there, because if they apply too, that reduces my chance of getting it. And that's the whole system which has kind of developed over the last 30 to 40 years of, yeah, competition for money, whether it's philanthropic money, competition for contracts, which is kind of fueled particularly post-COVID, where, you know, a bunch of money for COVID was funneled into our communities by the government, which is amazing. One of the organizations I worked with kind of got their first ever government mental health contract, even though they are the largest, not largest, longest serving mental health organization for Rainbow Communities in Aotearoa. They got their first little pot of money during COVID. But then all that money went away. So they created all this capacity in the community, then all that money went away to support it while the demand stayed the same or has even increased, as we've kind of seen this year. So all these drivers of competition between our groups, which is, at least in my opinion, really sad, because we know that when people work together, so much more good things happen. We feel better amongst ourselves. We're more productive and happy. We're more able to bring in new concepts, new ideas to our organization, or work with new people, because we are collaborating with others rather than keeping the lid on our Sistema container. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And I think collaboration is really important. And we've definitely seen some shifts in philanthropy over the last kind of 10, 15 years where they're moving more into a collaboration space, or at least in working in partnership with communities rather than a more transactional relationship. And some sectors still remain really marginalized by the way that philanthropy often operates. If you're thinking 20, 30 years ago, lots of smaller transactional funds, which still exist, and there's a lot of those people, organizations who will continue to and will be stuck in there because they might not necessarily have the capability, the capacity, or even the desire to scale to a level that is required, say, of government or some larger philanthropic groups who are trying to, you know, be more relational in the way that they're working. And so there's still going to be, there are still many kaupapa that will be shut out from getting really great resourcing to help them thrive in a more localised context. And so, yeah, I think that's a massive challenge for the sector. And also just going back to that competition thing, like I think it is really hard because the system has designed it that we are competitive against each other. And that's really sad because I think that when someone succeeds, we all succeed. And getting funding into a particular sector can help lift up others. And so if we can move more into that relational collaboration space, then lots of different kaupapa can thrive. We're just stuck in this place of competition. Yeah,
I absolutely agree. And I think there's a few things there. One is transactional philanthropy is still the vast majority of the types of grant funding that happens, right? Like if you look at even just those gaming trusts, they get about 130,000 applications each year, and about 90,000 of those are successful. So that is still the vast majority of how people interact with philanthropy. And the idea of this sort of collaborative, proactive funding is really just a very small number of funders at the moment. And although that's growing, I don't think it's ever going to really take over and be the primary way that people access resource. I think in terms of competition, there's a few things in there for me. One is philanthropy is absolutely set that up, right? We are competing with each other for a small pot of money, but there are processes that can help to unwind that. And participatory philanthropy is one of those, right? Where you get the people who are working in the sector or the people who are being affected by decisions, stepping into decision-making roles, rather than having that distance between the people who experience the outcome or the process or the service being so far apart from the people who are deciding what things happen. And for me, that's a really important tool for philanthropy becoming more equitable, because funding dictates so much of what communities are able to do and the directions that we go in, both as like small groups and communities and environments, and also as a country. And so the more we can get the decisions made on the ground by people who have real deep lived experience and expertise, the better those outcomes are going to be. And until we solve that, we're going to keep having that competitive environment. We're going to keep having this sort of, almost like trends in what philanthropy is willing to fund. And we're also going to continue to see the sort of focus on the shiny new projects rather than things that are deeply embedded in community and that we know work. And you see funders looking at that all of the time. Like, what is the new thing we can do? Where is the silver bullet that's going to solve this problem? Instead of looking at like what is deeply embedded in community, often kind of boring, but really effective in terms of creating long-term and systemic change. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that I'm always really aware of is how do we think about community organizations in Aotearoa? And I think in the introduction, you mentioned that we have a really prolific sector. We do have the most, I think we are the second most charities per capita in the world.
And part of that is just about what are our cultural narratives? And in New Zealand, my theory is, one, we've got a system where it's quite easy to set up a charity. You can set up an organisation. There's not too many constraints on that process, other than the time of the charity services team. But the other thing is around a narrative is really individually focused. So you have narratives around like, well, my experience was this, and so I want to set up an organisation that reflects my experience of this. And that's often how we think about things rather than going, oh, this is a topic I care about. How can I support the things that are already in existence? And so I think there's something about how do we, if we want to have a less competitive, more collaborative space, we need to change some of that narrative about why charities exist and why we set them up and establish them.
It's almost like you wrote a report on participatory philanthropy models 10 years ago, Lani. The example which jumped to mind as you're speaking is, you know, this the stat I heard a few years ago, there's 32 charities which focus on prostate cancer in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Like, 32, really? We at the Royal Foundation, we have taken on that participatory challenge, that participatory journey. Foundation North is doing a lot as well, but I can speak to this one in more detail in that a few years ago, we noticed that Taitokerau had really not been present and wasn't showing up in our funding applications. And because of our partnership with Foundation North, we had more pūtea to offer into Tamaki and Taitokerau. And so we didn't think it was fulfilling our obligations if we just gave all this money into Auckland because, you know, we're supposed to be looking after Taitokerau as well. And I'm not going to do that percentage on top of my head, but, you know, that's just not right. And so we have used what's called a closed participatory process. That's not the right name. Lani will tell us. But it's from Lani's report done a few years ago. And so we could have just created a funding round focused on Northland and said, hey, apply. We've got some pūtea just for you. But instead, we decided to go on a road trip. And through who we knew in Northland that was working within Rainbow Communities, we essentially invited them to a shared kui where we said, okay, you're the Rainbow groups that we know of in Taitokerau. Who else should be at the table? And then here's some pūtea and you got to decide how you spend it amongst yourselves. That worked pretty well. Impressively well, if I do say so myself, based on some of the kōrero we've just had. And over about 3 years, we've done 4 rounds of that. And what we're now starting to see emerge is, number one, they're inviting more people to the table. So it's not, they're not kind of keeping it to this closed group because they want to keep the money for themselves. And number two, there's a real care and aroha developing for everyone who is at the table. So there's a range of people. There are parents who run organizations for Rainbow Young People. There are Pride or Proud festivals, depending how you want to call it. There are other youth services in the mix. And this most recent round, one of the groups couldn't show up that had some things going on for them. But the kōrero in the room was like, well, we don't want them to miss out on this round because that could really mess up their funding for the next 12 months. So there was actually an allocation made to be set aside for them in case they needed it over the next 12 months rather than being distributed amongst themselves. So that was like, that's just been spoken of time and time again because that level of care and cooperation. We know that that happens when conditions are created for to happen, and it's on us to create those conditions. And they're also working more strategically as a region. So, you know, often they want to travel together down to some of the big Auckland events, and so they set up between all the groups working with young people, how do we do that together now? And so things like that are really cool to see. And I had one last thing, which was just the surprise, I think, from some of them about what goes into making a funding decision. So they always want more time to both speak and they always want more time to deliberate on decisions. And when you actually ask them, you say, no, this is your process. We're here to provide a space. We're here to facilitate the day. We'll provide the kai. But actually, you have to agree amongst yourselves how you're going to use this money. Maybe there's a few criteria, like no boozy parties, please. Party fine, just not the booze. But actually, other than that, this is entirely up to you. And so people sometimes have very different ideas about what they want to use the money for in their organizations. And that has to be discussed in the group. about not whether it's acceptable or not, but how people, you know, how do people rank, well, not rank, even that's the wrong word. How do people consider, you know, funding young people to go on a trip to the Big Gay Out versus funding the youth group that's happening in a location versus the costs to run a Pride festival. And when they actually sit together and start to discuss this, they're like, oh, this is hard. But because of the relationships that have been built and existed between them, they can have those robust discussions. And sometimes people don't get what they want. And people are also very caring that everyone gets what they want rather than just some people with the loudest voices. And I want to make a little distinction there. I think sometimes in philanthropy, we talk about spreading the jam. So one thing that happens is you've got $100,000 to give away. You've got $200,000 worth of applications. So you just give everyone half, because that's somehow fair. But actually now everybody is kind of messed up because they don't have what they need to deliver properly, but still feel like they have to deliver. And I think that's a little bit different to organizations themselves, despite deciding to distribute funding between themselves rather than, you know, fully funding some things, because people are actually involved in the decision about, oh, well, you know, I asked for 8,000, but if we only get 4 or 5, what does that mean? Oh yeah, we can, you know, we know what we can do for that. And that means this, the rest of this happens in the community because we're only taking 4 or 5. And we don't feel the obligation to make $8,000 worth of mahi happen because we've only got 4 or 5, because we've all made this decision together. So I think it's a really interesting and different way, very productive way of funding. But I think it connects all the way back to Lani's first point, is that I'm not sure that that's going to replace transactional philanthropy anytime soon, because it's takes a lot of work on behalf of the funders to deliver those kind of programs. And that's great, but it's hard to have small and local, as Dusty was talking about. And also, you know, Foundation North gives away about $73 million a year. And it would probably give away a lot less if it needed to give away all its money in that format, because it's quite staff intensive. And that's, I don't know, it's not nice to say that. Most people try not to say it, but it can be expensive to give away money well. And so that balance of transactional versus when is the latest trends to focus on a particular community or a particular region kind of has to balance out in some way. I know, don't just leave me hanging on that one.
I was kind of thinking about this kind of dynamic in particularly more progressive philanthropy or less transactional philanthropy, where there's this kind of grapple between operations and governance still. So you have lots of really awesome people who are really systems focused, doing amazing things, really deep relationships in the community, but the governance still holds the purse strings and may not be necessarily always on the same page with what's actually happening on the ground. Interesting thing, we were talking about the transactional stuff, because sometimes legacy will always trump the really progressive work that happens. But I also think that the really cool thing about some of that more progressive work is that it's not just when we're thinking about community organisations, it's not just those that are registered as charities or as an incorporated society. It's actually getting to individuals who are doing really awesome kaupapa. Like the community organisation is a broader kind of definition, because it is actually getting into those localized communities. But I just was wondering about that grapple between operations and governance. I don't know what you guys have observed in that space. Or can't say.
I'll say whatever I like. Maybe Lani's a bit more tactful. I've got two very different experiences, right? So Rural Foundation, we're a very small trust board, 5 people. I'm an advisor at the moment alongside those 5. And we feel a lot of responsibility and obligation to our community. We're also all from our community. And so although we're not a huge funder, we get to take risks and, you know, decide at one meeting, oh, yeah, we're going to change direction and do this. You know, that was what happened with Northland. We had a lot of funding applications from Tamaki, but actually we decided not to fund some so we could go to Northland and do this mahi. I don't want to say that was on a whim in a meeting, but it was something which came up, which was highly aligned to our values and what we felt our responsibility back to our community was. And, you know, next day we sent out an email. Hey, let's have a hui. It's a doodle poll. When should we do it? You know, perfect integration of governance and manage operations maybe. At the other end at Foundation North, they had a large board of 15 who were appointed by the Minister of Finance. And so that board can have a lot of political representation on it, as do the other 12 community trusts, which changes over time. And then it's a very hierarchical structure. So board of trustees, and the CEO reports to them. There's a leadership team which reports to the CEO, and then everyone else sits under that. So as a general employee at Foundation North, I don't really know our governance, and I do my work. And then, you know, hopefully a month or two later, the board has said, yes, we agree with your work and we're going to give that organization money or something else. You know, that's a very structured approach and very slow approach to how governance works or how it kind of changes and influences the organization. And I think one thing I've noticed at Foundation North as a result of this, and if any of my colleagues are listening, this is not a criticism, but Foundation North is very good at piloting stuff, but it's not very good at converting what's been piloted into the AU, business as usual, or their normal funding practices. So we had a reflection the other day. You know, all the community trusts were started by bank managers. The first person was a bank manager who decided who got money, and bank managers are very good at making forms. And what do we do 37 years later? We have a lot of forms. So that's how all the philanthropy is driven, from forms, because that's what the ASB former branch manager did in 1987. There's lots of things happened in 86 and 87. I can never remember which 2 years, including I was born in one of those years, but I do remember that one. Sorry, we're definitely getting silly now. You know, like when we started doing the Zapkin Experience Project and looking at it, it's like, sure, we have a digital online platform, but it's basically digital paper. And most of our internal systems are still digital paper. And how do you actually change that to something more like participatory philanthropy? But how do you actually do that at scale? Because it's really easy to just have digital paper. It's really easy to do what the gaming trusts do and just say, once you've ticked all the boxes, you're eligible. Honestly, I'm thinking if they're eligible, they probably just run a sum down their spreadsheet to figure out how much everyone gets. Approved, done. It takes a lot of work and dedication to turn a larger ship where you don't have control over your own governance, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'd say that I can't remember, it might have been Robin Scott, who's like the current CEO of Philanthropy New Zealand, who said once you've met one philanthropic organisation, you've met one philanthropic organisation. And I think that's really true. Like we often try and lump everybody together, but actually institutional philanthropy has really different constraints depending on what type of organization it is. You know, even if you think about family foundations, is the founder still alive? Are they still influencing decision making, or is this a you know 200-year-old organization where there's been lots of strategic change over time? I mean, there's really different constraints for those different philanthropic organizations. And I think sometimes when you're sitting on the outside, which I am now, it's really easy to be like, everyone should be doing this. But the reality is that's really challenging, as you said, to move a large ship. And I think when you're working in philanthropy, your job really is to be a bit of a mediator, right? Like, or a translator, maybe is better language, is like, what is community asking for? What does community need? What is going to make life better? And how do I then take that narrative and that story and that change and request for transformation and make it something that people who might have very different life experiences and who are making the decisions here, the final decisions, how do I help them to understand that and see those threads and how those things all link together? So I think that's a big role for people who work in philanthropy. And I think the other thing that I find really important to emphasize all the time to people who are making decisions is social change is a pie, right? Like if you imagine it as a pie, philanthropy is like the thinnest slice. We are a support function. And I think the narrative is often that philanthropy is the hero here. And philanthropy is not. Philanthropy is like, it's a resource. It's a support function. It is not actually leading change. And I think we need to make sure that that is emphasized because we have a lot of hero stories, particularly internationally, about people who've made a lot of money and then they come in and they create change. They didn't create the change. They just resourced it.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think going back to that mediatory role between the operations and the governance, I think just from a practical experience of being sometimes on the philanthropic side and sometimes on the fundraiser side, is that the deepest, longest relationships that I hold with funders are the ones where they do play that mediatory role really, really well. So they're actually really active in supporting your application to them. They're having lots of discussions with you. They're trying to understand your kaupapa so that they can best represent you, but also say it in a language that makes sense to their board or whoever they're reporting to. So I think, yeah, that role is just hugely important.
What a great kōrero, guys. You've touched on so much already. Something I'd be really keen to hear about is the, and I think we touched on it, but perhaps didn't get into it too much, was funding priorities at the moment and how you think those may or may not be changing across time.
Wow.
Like, something that I've observed is that many of those more relational philanthropists or funders are looking for solutions that are really going to have really impactful localized solutions. And what that looks like is that they are really deeply invested in relationships, but also in understanding their relationship to te tiriti or waitangi. And, you know, just acknowledging that it is a journey. So not everyone's going to get it right, but they're really leaning into that and looking for kaupapa Māori solutions, what's working well in communities, being in relationship with people who are really just there in the community, in the grassroots and the flax roots, doing the mahi. And I think that's really exciting. And recently I've been working with a researcher who found that there's quite a strong perception of New Zealanders that as te tiriti is a solution for community good, for Te Taiao in particular. And so some of the areas where I think that there's been a growth in philanthropic funding is in environment and climate change, but also in the decolonisation space. And it feels like, and maybe this is just because of my experience of working with my marae and with iwi, is that there seems to be more focus on supporting marae and other Māori communities as a central form part of their community. I think the thing that I like to talk about is, like, you know, back in the day you used to think about the Anglican Church as like the center of the community, and now, you know, it feels like there's a shift towards the marae as the center of the community, and that's where our well-being lays. And so there's lots of revitalization and support for that type of kaupapa, that mindset shift to a more, I don't know, Aotearoa way of thinking or te tiriti based way of thinking.
I think my father would argue it's the Catholic Church, actually, that used to be the centre of community rather than Anglican, but we can move past that. I agree. At the kind of the more micro level within Rainbow Community Funding, we're seeing a lot of funding at the intersections. So a lot of organisations springing up over the last few years, Indian Origin Pride, Ataka Aotearoa, Chinese Pride, Ethnic Rainbow Alliance, and a lot of Māori First, Rainbow Second type groups, or Pacific First, Rainbow Second type groups. We're seeing a huge growth in that space in the rainbow sector, where I think there's a progressive, I don't want to say rejection, that's not quite the right word, but a progressive move away from the strong Western identity of rainbow as something to be or belong to, and more of a holistic or overall view of what your identity is. What's interesting is when we look at rainbow communities as a priority across Aotearoa or internationally, so the most up-to-date research we have is from Lani, where LGBTQIA plus people who have self-identified themselves as part of the census, it's about 5% of Aotearoa's population, but it's only a priority in 1.3% of Lani's 2,500 funding opportunities. And when we look internationally, I think the most recent data I have is a few years old now, but there was something like only 5 cents out of every $100 given internationally went to rainbow communities. Now, these trends are improving, and I don't necessarily agree with the idea that, you know, because we're 5% of the population, 5% of the money should come to us, because we know that rainbow communities have all sorts of multifaceted intersectional identities, so that makes sense. But The big one that stands out for me is that rainbow communities used to be one of the priority communities for lotteries funding. And in their recent strategic review, that was removed. I think it was the only one that was removed. Please correct me if I'm wrong. So there is that kind of political shift that's influencing people. It's influencing trust boards. And I feel very lucky to work at Foundation North, which has been very supportive of rainbow communities over a long time. But I asked one of the Foundation North trustees to see who out of the other 12 trusts was also rainbow. You know, how many trustees were there on these? There's 132 trustees nationally across 12 trusts. Let's not get into how efficient or otherwise that is. But when he looked through them, he could only find one other trustee who identified as openly identified as rainbow on these boards. And of course, we knew who they were, and they're actually the lawyer for Royal Foundation. That's just how our community works. But, you know, it's that issue just, I mean, it just goes hand in hand with representation or being comfortable with being your full self, whatever that looks like. Rainbow is just one part of that, into these spaces or not. Yeah.
I can talk just briefly about the data that we released. So what we did was obviously Fund Sauna has information about 1,200 funders and about 12,500 funding opportunities. And so what we did was a census looking at what do funds explicitly say that they will prioritize. That doesn't necessarily align with how much money goes into each of these areas. That's another piece of research we'll do in the new year. But it was really interesting. I mean, I think the things that were at the top were really general funds, which is people who are fund kind of anything. Environmental issues were the second highest, which was really interesting and feels like a real cultural shift from, say, about 2019, which is when we've got the last good data from. And then arts and education were up really high as well. And I think for me, that says that more attention is going to issues that have lower levels of complexity generally. You know, environment, arts, sports are getting more funds than things that involve, you know, vulnerability and social marginalization and identity-based inequalities and systemic injustice. And when we think about philanthropy, for me, it was always supposed to be risk capital for social change. And so that data shows us that that isn't actually what's happening. And I don't think any of us will be particularly surprised by that. But if we look at the other end, what isn't being prioritized, it is the rainbow communities, it is ethnic communities, migrants and refugees. And the thing that appeared the least frequently as a priority was family and sexual violence. And for me, that all of this is worth talking about. But that is one where actually over a million New Zealanders are affected by family and sexual violence, and that's probably at the lower end. And yet almost no funding goes into that space. And so I think there's some things to examine about, one, it's a reflection of our culture, but also who are the decision makers? What do they care about? What are they comfortable talking about as well? And so this, I agree with you, Duncan, that there's we need to be working on what is the diversity of the decision makers, but also what is the depth of knowledge that they have about some of the issues that are affecting communities that might not look like them regardless.
Lani, did you just describe climate as being one of the easy problems to solve?
Or environment.
Environment, sorry. Right. Environment.
None of these are actually easy issues to solve. Thank you for calling out. But they do, I think there are some like fewer complexities in some ways. And certainly when we were talking about that really low percentage, that 0.8% of funds prioritize family and sexual violence, One of the interesting things that came up from some philanthropists was, but government is already funding in that space, so we don't have to. And so, like, for me, it was really interesting that things like environmental issues and education were right up the top. Those are also well-resourced by government. Well, it depends on the government, but you know, more likely to be prioritised by government. So there's just some real interesting contradictions in there as well. But you're right, climate is not an easy thing to solve.
Sorry, I thought it was worth a laugh. and interesting, you know, changes to education funding might be 1% or 2% of their annual budget, whereas what they were funding into the sexual and domestic violence space, you know, they were doing a cross-agency piece of work, and they basically just removed 80 or 90% of that funding with the current government. I know that's not the services potentially delivered, but, you know, that removing 80% of funding is quite different to removing 2% of funding in education. Yeah.
One thing that's been going through my mind as I've been listening to you, particularly, Tase, when you're talking about the Māori kōpapa organisations being well-researched and some of these groups that aren't being so well-funded, yet how much of that is in response to what's happening at a political level?
I think that probably the there will be a small correlation. However, I think that this is a long, deep shift that we've seen. And so, you know, it's this research that I talked about. I can't really talk about heaps about it, but the earlier research definitely didn't see fertility as a solution to some of the challenges that we face in society. And so that definitely has shifted. And like, you even only have to look at things like the support for Māori wards to go, there has definitely been a shift. And so I think that it is just a general growing awareness and desire from most New Zealanders, because we all share lots of values, to actually do the right thing. So I think there's the philanthropic point of view of wanting to do the right thing, and that's to like throw resource at things. And then there's just the general societal value that we place on what is the right thing to do and how do we take care of each other. And so there is, feel like, that sense of collectiveness to shift things for all of us, because when we do the right thing, everyone benefits.
It's so good to hear, because I feel like it can be quite depressing, maybe a little strong, but the world can be quite depressing sometimes. So it's nice to hear that you think there's a positive trend in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's just that, like, this year in particular, the last kind of 18 months, it is far more visible because we have a government that is undoing a lot of things. But I think this has been a long swell that's been growing. And yeah, we're just kind of seeing the fruits of it now. Yeah.
As we wrap up our kōrero today, what would you guys hope to see, or what kind of drives you? What would you like to see if we had a kind of magic wand?
I think it's easy for me, and it relates to something that Lani said, is just if you are in these positions to make decisions or influence who makes decisions, I think there is a responsibility there to take a risk. I had to write down Lani's terms. I remembered it. Giving money away, philanthropy, should be risk capital for social change. There's lots of amazing community things which happen day in, day out, which deserve funding. We should fund them. But if we're just funding that and not funding for the future, that's a great tagline. I'm sure that's been rolled out in many places. You know, then actually we are sitting here just sort of treading water or keeping up with the flow rather than thinking about what is in the future. And you can't make one decision. You can't figure out what the perfect answer is. You're not going to know that in advance. Like, the general idea of evolution in general is that you have to try a bunch of different things before you actually know what will be successful, what will work. And we kind of need to apply that lens, at least to part of our funding, in order to get there.
I think for me it would be so charity, and the idea of charity requires some level of inequality in order for it to exist. And philanthropy is part of the system that in some ways upholds inequalities. And so if I had a magic wand, I would have it all shift from charity to mutual aid, where we're all supporting each other and we're all generous with each other, not because we have some ideology around that, but because we value everyone and every community and the wellness of all of the things around us.
Yeah, thanks, Lani. I think, she's just going to change it slightly and say what I want to say to philanthropists and to people working in philanthropy is that we really need to lift our gaze to a horizon where we all thrive. And when we do that, when we look at those systems and the structures that are held in place, we can start to change. We start to change our perception of what those downstream effects are going to be for our communities, and we can see the value and how important the small kaupapa are, the big kaupapa, and the different ways of doing things and making sense of the world are really important. And then we can divert our resources to those things too, because I think there's lots of value and lots of different things, not just in the traditional philanthropy sense where we really focus on sport and those real visible, tangible things that we see, to the things that we really actually value in our communities and that's us all thriving together.
Tēnā koutou. It seems like a really nice place to end on. Thank you so much for this kōrero. I've learnt heaps and I've come away feeling really inspired about things, which is nice. I hadn't actually expected necessarily to come away feeling inspired, because as thinking more along the lines of who misses out on the funding, but I have had a sense from you guys that maybe overall we're kind of trending in a positive way, which is really great. Thank you so much.
Kia ora, thank you.
Thank you so much. Kia ora koutou. Kia kite.
Kia kite.